Okay, our final hour here with Gary Grossman as we talk about his work, Old Earth. We're going to talk with him about the Vatican next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Gary Grossman with us, of course, his work, Old Earth. Gary, what about the Vatican? Tell me a little bit about that relationship in your book with
the
Vatican.
Well, you know, actually, as I've been thinking about everything during the break, I've gotten so much from your show that's in the book, and it's not just using Coast to Coast in the book and having you on and John Greenwald, but I have a character who is a brother astronomer. He's a priest who is an astronomer, a Vatican priest, and he's fashioned after a guest you've had on that I almost did a TV show with, and that's Father Guy Consolmagno.
Ah, yes.
Brother Guy, who is fascinating and kind of speaks to the whole issue. If the church was so far from the truth at the time of Galileo, who again is a figure as I go back and forth in time in the book Old Earth, and they took the position that they took at that time, really probably knowing, as many politicians do today, well, it's not going to last, but we have our power, so that's what we have to do, and we have to keep our power. Well, here's a priest in the book, Gareth Eccleston, my character, but he's based on Brother Guy, and he's an astronomer, and he's a Galileo expert. So it allowed me, again, to bring that discussion back and forth between science and religion, and how does a man of faith square science, and I'm sure I know you've explored this with Brother Guy, and that we're not alone, which does fly in the face of a lot of what the church would traditionally say and has traditionally said. And Brother Guy, or actually Father Eccleston in the book, is someone who can again move the story along and take us through the Vatican and the Vatican secret archives. Now, in this case, I thought it would be fun to explore a little bit more of the truth of what the Vatican archives are compared to what we read in Angels and Demons, which was great. And Dan Brown is a fabulous writer. I can only aspire to be as wonderful as he is. But the Vatican archives are not really that secret. They're called the Vatican Secret Archives, but you and I could go in with an appointment and look at virtually everything as long as we're not just walking through the aisles. We have to have very specific requests. And it really comes down to the word secret. The word secret from Greek and then Latin is really more about secretary, recording information, holding and storing the information, being the secretary of the archives. But in the translation and the epistemology of the word, we kind of lean on its secret, the Vatican Secret Archives. It makes for great fiction, and I just kind of had a wink and a nod to Dan Brown in that. But it was, it's a place where we explore the story more and get a sense of what it means to be a man of religion and have faith in science. So it becomes very critical, and as the action is really leading up to the end in Old Earth, the priest becomes a much more important character. And I write from real experience, because I did go to an apartment I described and the areas of the Vatican I described with a Paulist priest, because I had been doing a number of TV shows with the Paulist priests in Paulist Productions in Los Angeles through my production company, Weller Grossman, including a TV special for History called Beyond the Da Vinci Code. And we explored what was real and what was not real in the Da Vinci Code. So, again, I'm constantly weaving what I do in television with what my interests are and what I love to write about.
Oh, good for you. I'm baffled with the Vatican having two observatories.
Isn't that something? And
yeah.
One in Arizona and one at the Pope's summer villa.
That's right.
And they are Well, Brother Guy certainly talks about this, very, very focused on the possibilities of providing the proof that everyone is looking for. You know, everyone is believing. Wouldn't it be interesting if even the Catholic Church found evidence and was able to present it? And again, it gets back to the dilemma that I get to, that I mentioned earlier in the interview, is if you do find that information, do you release it? And as you said, yes, we have the responsibility
yep.
to release that information.
Why don't we do it? Let's take some calls here for you, Gary. Let's go to Charles in Grandview, Arkansas, to get things going east of the Rockies. Hey, Charles, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, George, I met you before, and my story is kind of a reality in my life, and it's unbelievable to even comprehend what has happened to me in the past. But I've been led to the location of the Lost Templar Treasure in Nova Scotia, and its religious artifacts are there, and the story itself would make an unbelievable movie.
I bet it would.
The removal of the treasure on film would be quite a unbelievable documentary.
Is the treasure still there, Charles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had a reading done on it by a lady here in Arkansas, and she hit right on the money. And it's unbelievable. And everybody I contact, I don't get any response to.
Are you the only one who physically knows that it's there?
Oh, no. I've told everybody in the world about it. I'm waiting for somebody to. With underground penetration equipment, view what's in the ground. The three locations have been mapped out by a professional treasure hunters.
So it's in three. It's in three spots, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, about 100 feet away from each other. And the reason, if I give a quick explanation, it makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
The boat in 1445, the boat came to Nova Scotia, and it come up on a reef and broke the bottom of the boat, and they took on water, and they came in on the side of an island where it was the only place they could land to keep from sinking. And while they were there, they removed the treasures and put them into the ground in three spots. They returned back to Scotland, and the boat went down on the way back, so they never could release the exact location of where they unloaded the treasure, and this makes it the Lost Templar Treasure. The cross of Christ is there, and about 4.5 tons of gold. And in another remote, 1,500 feet into the woods, there's another remote spot. We dug a 10-foot hole and then come right close to where it's located. But in a half a day's time with ground-penetrating radar, everything would be explained as to what's in the ground.
Can you estimate, Charles, how much that treasure is worth today?
The gold's worth about $2 billion, and I don't know what the cross price. The reading was, there's a cross put into the ground with the image of Christ on it. Now, what more could that be that the Templars were bringing from Scotland all the way to America?
But nobody will listen. Nobody will go out there and test it for you and look for it?
Well, pardon me?
What's that?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just need to get the one person that would want to meet me there the knowledge of underground penetrating equipment. A man from Florida told me with what happens with the L rods in one spot, that the place is loaded with, there's a 25-foot circle that gives a reading under it, where I think that's where the gold is located.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning this to me when we met up at one of the events. I think you were at the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference last year. That's kind of fascinating, Gary.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it reaches right into the heart of what we've been talking about. What's out there that we don't possibly know? And I speak about the characters in Old Earth. They say if we've only investigated an infinitesimal amount of the one-fifth of our planet that is above ground, when four-fifths of the planet is underwater now, portions of that didn't used to be underwater, what is there yet to discover in the four-fifths of the planet that we haven't ever been able to explore? And what Charles is talking about, it just brings up that very point. What is out there that we don't know? And you know, here again, in Italy, they discovered a 4,000-year-old city while trying to fix their toilet. So it's astounding, and thank goodness for people like Charles who are literally digging for the truth.
What do you think of UFO visitations right now? Ongoing?
Ongoing. And, you know, certainly I explored so much of it in our documentaries that we did for the History Channel. And many of the readers of Old Earth are really drawn into thinking maybe the explanation of what I talk about is UFOs. It's not. But with all the work that we've done and the explanations, and I even had an unusual sighting in the middle of L.A. while walking our dog a couple of months ago, lights like I have never seen and darting around like I have never seen.
Weird things.
I'm not a skeptic. I'm a believer who would love, from childhood's end, that alien spaceship to land at the United Nations so that we, you know, have the ultimate proof. Unless, of course, the ultimate proof is not going to be to our advantage, and we're not going to be happy about that. But there's so much that we can't discredit people for what they've seen, when here I am saying, I saw something that was absolutely inexplicable to me here in Los Angeles, in a very well-lit city, and there are helicopters, there's everything in the sky, but nothing moved like this thing that I saw.
Let's go to James in Philadelphia now, first-time caller. James, good morning.
Good morning to you, George Norrie, and good morning to your guest. I'm sitting here, George, enthralled with the show. Let me say, Mr. Grossman, I hope your book is available in audio form, because I happen to be a visually impaired person, so I read my books via audio.
It absolutely is. It's available in Audible, print, and ebook, and the reader did an extraordinary job on the Audible version. He's a wonderful actor.
I intend to go. I'm a devotee of the thriller genre, and I particularly love books that weave science and history. I'm a huge James Rollins fan. I'm sure you're familiar with him, being that you're a part of the Thriller International Thriller Association. He's another writer who does this, weaves science and uses science and history through in his novels. But my question to you is this. I've become fascinated with the research, and I want to know, have you had anything to do with this, the History Channel that I've seen, with the discoveries, I think, over in Turkey, about the possibility that there may have been atomic blasts around two, maybe three, far back as 4,000 years
ago. That would be India.
India,
yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, Mr. Grossman, have you had anything to do with any of that documentary, and do you think that there's some validity to that?
Well, I have not seen the documentary. I have heard the stories, and you're right, India, George. And again, I just have to say, quoting Carl Sagan, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. We need to find out more to be able to prove it, but it doesn't mean it hasn't occurred or it didn't occur. And with every bit of science that we have at our disposal now, including, as Charles was talking about, ground-penetrating radar and the ability to have, key is to have access to the places. If they can be open to investigation and we can dig down far enough to get, you know, accurate readings. But no, I haven't done a show on that myself.
Is Old Earth going to be a movie?
Oh, I would love that so much. Of course, I'm trying to generate interest. The book just came out 3 weeks ago, but every time somebody is talking about it, it certainly makes it more possible. And I think it would just make an incredible thriller, but even more than that, an incredible thriller that would make people think about the possibilities.
Absolutely. Let's go to Don, east of the Rockies, Kent, Ohio. Don, I didn't see you at the event.
No, I'll tell you what, my son had my first grandchild, and I had to catch a quick flight over to Bethesda, Maryland.
That's a much better reason, believe me. Good for you.
I miss you guys, though. Hey, the question I wanted to ask, everybody knows, according to science, that the dinosaurs were killed as a result of a comet striking Yucatan Peninsula 65 million years ago. But when we get in the book of Job, it describes Behemoth. It says, "Behold, Behemoth, which I made with thee." And then if you get into 41st chapter, it talks about another dinosaur, because a dinosaur is an invention. It was never mentioned in the Bible. It's a composite of 19th century terms. But it refers to Leviathan, and it says, "Hast thou let down a hook or draw him out with a cord?" And these are nautical terms. So Behemoth is a land-based dinosaur, whereas Leviathan is a sea creature. So we have these two dinosaurs living contemporaneously with man. How does that shake out with the older theories?
Well, you just hit on an element of my sequel, which is I hint at the very end of the book. And it was, I had written it a different ending, and then I realized I had just written a tease for the movie Godzilla, and we've all seen that. So I changed the ending, and I really came up with something very similar to what you're talking about that kind of focuses on discovery or the belief that there's a creature in North Africa, or actually Central Africa. And I find it fascinating that again, we don't know what we don't know, and we haven't even explored all the areas that are in the rainforests and the regions that we just consider unapproachable for political or weather-related issues even. You know, look at what's happening with the glacier melt in Antarctica. It is, what is it, the Totten Glacier? That is becoming, it's melting at a phenomenal rate.
That's melting. Others are growing. It's just the whole planet's upside down.
Upside down. So who knows what we'll discover as that melts, and we'll have access to the water that's there. So I you're absolutely, Don, hitting on something that I just had to smile, because it's the potential sequel for Old Earth, and you'll see it at the very end of the, or you'll hear it at the very end of the novel.
And Gary, you're on Twitter now too, right?
Yes, I am. It's at Gary Grossman 1, the number 1, at Gary Grossman 1, and my website is very easy, GaryGrossman.com.
Good, and we've got that linked up for you. And we're going to come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment, Gary, right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll be talking about the supernatural, the Ouija boards, the electronic voice phenomena as well, and then we'll have those open lines on Coast to Coast AM. And now here, by the way, is a criticalhealthnews.com report from pharmacist Ben Fuchs. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Gary Grossman. We'll get to your final calls here. Gary, you also wrote a book that talked about, and we mentioned it briefly, Russian sleeper cells. I would assume we've got sleeper cells there, too.
Oh, yes, we do. We sure do. But I'm not sure we're as good as they've been in getting sleeper cell spies here, largely because the Russians didn't do it right at first. They infiltrated, they put people into the U.S. who were not really trained to pass as Americans. This was in the 1940s and the 1950s for the most part. And they would haggle when we don't haggle. They wouldn't know how to go into a grocery store and buy things the way we know. And they got a little smarter. They started a school called the Drop-Off Institute and had a special curriculum there called Red Banner. And what they did at a number of secret cities in Russia, Z-A-T-O, Zato cities, was train Russians to learn how to pass as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed them to come in at a time in the 1960s, the 70s, and to some extent the 80s, where they would blend in and in many cases wait. And in the case of Executive Actions, the book that you're talking about that really focuses on that, aim for the biggest prize possible, and that's the presidency itself. And could they insert a sleeper spy in the White House? Now, what's crazy is that today we're a country filled with accents everywhere you walk. In St. Louis is the same as Los Angeles, in New York, in Chicago, in You turn left, you turn right, you're hearing different languages. You're hearing and seeing people from everywhere that seems more normal, and they don't have to pass as Americans and can still be equally as effective. But back in the 70s and the 80s, and the TV show The Americans on FX deals with this, there were people who came over here and not only were spies, but they had children, and they were raising the children to become spies.
And I've always wondered, too, that what if you had a presidential candidate who truly was a liar until he got elected? Now, one could say, well, they all are. But you just never know.
Well, you never know, and Executive Actions deals with that. And the other, to me, one of the other scary things that comes out of the Andropov Institute and Red Banner, although he didn't come over here as a sleeper spy, but Putin went through the Andropov University or Andropov Institute and was trained in all the ways that understanding American psychology. And if you consider all the buttons he pushes, he's pushing them so well because he understands where we will react or where we won't react. And that all comes with training.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating for, you know, with Executive Actions, it just keeps becoming, it never is unpopular because every election cycle, and now we're facing another one, deals with these ultimate questions. And you certainly went into it with Craig Hewlett earlier and callers, but they're questions that make you question, that make you wonder, do we know everything about the people who are running for office? And how can we find out? How can we find out more?
Next up, Luke is in Ontario, Canada, on the international line. Hey, Luke, thanks for calling. Good morning.
Hey, George. Hey, Gary. How are you doing?
Hi,
good.
Luke. Thank you.
Good.
Okay. I find that fascinating that you bring up the sleeper possibility of an executive. However, my original question I was going to ask was about the Vatican files. And in studying about 10 different religions, I've never come across a reference that perhaps, just like some people talk about the Big Bang now, maybe there were multiple Big Bangs. Have you ever seen a reference in the Vatican or in Vatican circles that there's maybe more than one Yahweh? Like, is there a whole planet of Yahweh somewhere? I've got another question, if we have time.
Well, I haven't come across it. It's a fascinating question. And if you've got an inclination to write a novel, I think it would make a great one, or a nonfiction book exploring it, but I haven't come across it.
And what's your other question there, Luke?
The other question is, a former Russian-backed group in Canada called the Thompson Mafia have paid over $240 million to Obama, and they're in Canada, and I've tried to expose it. How do we expose an executive that's on the payroll for the former communist Soviet Union?
Wow. that's a million-dollar question. I don't know. I think you start with people like John Greenwald to find out what documents he could possibly uncover. They give you proof and evidence. You're on the radio now talking about it. That's a way. And to get enough people to start thinking about questioning and wanting to know. It's really where it all begins. You know, it begins with investigative journalism, and you don't have to be a journalist, an investigative journalist, to do that these days.
All right, we've got Doug now, truck driving in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for calling, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, this is the first time I ever got through. Anyways, I tuned in kind of late to your show and stuff, but the one thing I got to say is you were talking about the Russians and stuff, is being a truck driver, they are everywhere in trucks. I mean, and it seems like they all got their own uniforms of wearing sweatpants with flip-flops. And but they are everywhere, and I just don't know, you know, what's going on there. So, but I do have a question, and I don't know if I heard you mention something about UFOs and stuff. Do you know anything about stuff like that?
Oh, we all do. Sure. What's the question, though, Doug?
Okay, well, I've had so many encounters and everything. I even got in a physical fight with one. But my biggest thing is, a question I got is one night I was in, I had a big truck, you know, with a big sleeper in it and everything. And I went and I stopped in Brookville, Pennsylvania, and I went to bed. I woke up, and there was two people standing inside my truck, you know, and they didn't come through the doors. And, you know, I was scared and stuff, and I asked them, you know, who they were, and they said they were angels, you know, and there was a man and a woman. And the man never spoke at all. There was just a woman that spoke. And she, you know, we talked for a bit and everything, and then I asked them if they were good angels or bad angels, you know, and yeah. She just ran her finger down her fingers down her side like Milo would and said, well, look at us, we're angels. And so then I asked them to leave, and they left.
Just like that.
But then,
what do they look like, Doug?
Oh, that was kind of a cute thing too. They were all white. They had like a white shirt, long sleeve shirts, and then white slacks, you know, and like a pantsuit type thing. The woman had like a little red stripe going down her arms and stuff, and the man didn't. And they had this like white aura around them, and then about a month later, I went and stopped at another place on Highway 80, about 100 miles east of there. I ran out of hours, and so walked across the street, and there was a restaurant and bar in there and stuff. And so I sat there and talked to, you know, the bartender and stuff. And finally, the place, you know, it got empty, and her and I got talking. And I told her, I said, you know what? And I told her the same story I just told you. And she told me to stop right there. Because I will tell you exactly what they look like. And she described them to a T. You know, and then I said, well, how do you know that? She said that she was going to college at Penn State to become a psychologist. And she already had 6 years in. And that she would, they teach them in Penn State there all about aliens and ghosts and about angels and stuff. And she had told me they were Nordics. And...
Which is a race of extraterrestrials.
Okay, well, I didn't know. But she said that me stopping there was no accident, that they arranged me for to run out of hours and for me to talk to her, and that where she could make me more comfortable, because she said they were coming back, you know, that they had something to tell me.
Well, that's a great story, though. I mean, what would be jarring to me would be waking up in your cab to have these two beings in there. That's a no-no as far as I'm concerned, Gary.
That would just throw me.
Of all the stories you've uncovered and investigated, is there one that stands out for you to be one of the most fantastic?
In the UFO realm?
All genres.
All genres. Wow. What a fascinating question. I don't know. I you know, the Jasper Maskelyne story that I talked about, the war illusionist from Great Britain in World War II, was absolutely fascinating, and I'd never come across anything quite like that, where there's such a fish out of water who has become so important in the war. But, I think it probably comes down to ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that's what you find in so many of the UFO stories, you know, certainly what we've just heard on the phone now. People who are thrown into a situation and they just have to deal with it. But the ultimate experience for me, that's a great question. I'm not so sure. I'm fascinated with all the lives that I've done biographies for, mm-hmm. and all the documentaries. But I think it's not necessarily the greatest people who are the heroes. It's the ordinary people who are the heroes, and they're yet to be discovered.
Let's go to Denny in Dana Point, California. Hi, Denny. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Okay.
Good evening.
You were talking about the how the Earth is, perhaps we are hundreds of millions of years old. And, I was thinking about the technology, perhaps, than those people had in the old days, and the way technology is developing now to the point where we have bio 3D printers and we can manage stem cells, and we're going to get to the point one day where we perhaps will become a creator, on ways. And I was wondering, how long it's going to take us to achieve such a stage in life to perhaps get to the point as well where we will have, androids and et cetera. And our universe is, to us is so gigantic, but perhaps it's just the size of a keychain, and what is beyond this is hard to imagine in comparison to perhaps the evolution of some beings that we cannot even imagine the way they look like, perhaps who have attained such a state where they are in such a state of bliss with nothing, in perfect happiness. And so it's really, how long do you think it's going to take us to achieve such a state where we will be such in a state of evolution where we won't have any problems anymore? And do you think it's going to take us, it's going to be hard for us to achieve that state without destroying ourselves on the planet? Perhaps like it already happened five or six times just because of an evolution which went way too fast into technology.
Well, I think it's going to happen sooner than later. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, and I agree. And I'll reverse engineer your question a little. One of my favorite things, and it's in Old Earth, is to look at Earth's clock time, 4.6 billion years, as if it were a one-hour clock. So adjust 4.6 billion years to 1 hour. In that first 100th of a second, the Earth's crust was formed. And it wasn't until about 2 minutes in that we start seeing the oldest rocks on Earth, and the first fossil evidence is at about around 2.5 minutes, first bacteria around 3.5 minutes. We get to, as you kind of follow that sweep of the clock, jellyfish are, not even to get to jellyfish yet, the first cells with a nucleus end up being at about 40 minutes into the hour. Dinosaurs that, we consider prehistoric in every way comes really at about the 57-minute mark in looking at 4.6 billion years as 1 hour. We come along, first modern man in that one-hour version of that time is at 59 minutes, 59.9 seconds. So we're an infinitesimal amount. And to George's point, looking at time that way, what you're talking about is really tomorrow. It's, not necessarily the day after today, but clockwise, it's so soon. And could that same kind of thing have happened before? Well, that's part of the premise of Old Earth. But it, more than that, it's the research that so many great researchers have done over the years and have been guests on Coast to Coast. And
Gary, let's keep in touch. You're in L.A. and I'm in L.A. a lot, so we shall do that. Gary Grossman, the book Old Earth. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.